record interviews with us. So we have two guests coming up here at Skulltoll. We have first Michelle Barker, who recorded an interview for us some time ago and is actually going to be releasing a novel very soon and will be on the show again sometime next month before her novel is released. She'll probably be on our April 19th show. And then also we have Daniela, and she's going to also be our second guest. And so as we have little time to waste, as they have a lot of wonderful things to say and a lot of wonderful artwork to share with us, then why don't we get to it right after a word from these guys?
I'm Ryan Beal.
And I'm Kevin Lee.
The ShitArborDid.com comedians are coming to your campus. It's like the website, but in real life.
Come see the Sunday Service, who was recently named Canada's best improv group.
Guess what? The show was hosted by Graham Clark of Stop Podcasting Yourself, awarded Canada's best podcast.
The comedy will be followed by presentations by Brigitte Depape,
the Senate Rogue Page, and founder of ShitArborDid.com, Sean Devlin.
It'll be coming to UBC on March 18th at 6:30 p.m.
Entry by donation at the North Theater.
The event is sponsored by CITR 101.9 FM. And Sean Devlin, founder of ShitHarborDid.com, will personally be doing a push-up for a dollar. If you pay him $100, he'll do 100 push-ups at every event. So come.
Learn.
In my pants.
Laugh.
In my pants.
And you are tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM here on Skulls Hall, and we have our very next guest, Michelle Barker. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Oh, I'm great.
And I'm sure that all of our listeners out there would like to know, who is Michelle Barker?
Well, I'm a writer. I live up in Penticton, BC. I was born and raised in Vancouver. I write mostly poetry and fiction at this point, but I've been writing for about 20 years, so I've done a variety of different things. Started out to writing newspaper articles and some magazine pieces, and wrote a couple of novels that died, which was a good thing. I've written a novel for young adults that's coming out at the end of March, actually. Short fiction, some other creative nonfiction, variety of different things. I've worked as an editor. I've led creative writing workshops, and that's about it, I think.
Oh, I see. So you've worked in a variety of different things.
I have, yes.
I see. And you also have a past history here at UBC as well?
I do. I did my undergrad here. I did a degree in English literature, started a degree in comparative literature, a master's, and lasted one semester. Sorry, complet. Didn't work out for me. That was pretty much when I realized that I wanted to be a writer. And so I left school for about, well, I guess probably about 20 years. And I've just returned in the last couple of years to do a master's in creative writing.
I see. And that is currently ongoing?
It is, yeah.
I see.
I'm in the optional residency program, so that means most of it is done online.
Oh, and that makes it a lot easier when you're living as far away from UBC as you are.
Oh, yeah. That's the advantage of the program, actually, because we have people from all over the world who participate in it. And then the optional part of it is that you can come down in the summers and do workshops if you want to, but you don't have to. And so a lot of us get together in the summers for these workshops, and then we go off on our different directions and work from home. So it works out great.
Yes, and I can attest to programs like that. My first graduate degree was done in a similar fashion. I did it through distance learning from England while I was living in Japan. So that was kind of fun. All right, so how did you end up starting off as an artist? What was it that inspired you to share your work with the world?
Oh, boy. Well, it's funny. Brian and I were talking before the program started, and he was saying how he'd gotten talked out of some things. And I think that was sort of my beginning as well as an artist. I had thought that I'd wanted to be a writer for most of my life, probably. And then once I got into university, I think I let my parents talk me out of it, because it wasn't practical to be a writer, and it was sort of a frivolous idea, and it was a much better idea to be a lawyer. So that was sort of the direction I was heading in, and then I ended up in complet for a little while. Realized I wanted to be a writer, and I think that writing and sharing your work with the world pretty much go hand in hand, at least they do for me, because I feel like if you're going to write, you want to communicate, and the only way to communicate as a writer is to publish. So that's it just sort of seemed to go hand in hand.
I see. And do you have a list of published works yet?
I do. I have a chapbook that I put out just this summer with Leaf Press, a chapbook of poetry, a mini chapbook, which is about as small as it gets, with the Centrifugal Eye. And I have a novel, as I said, coming out at the end of March with Thistledown Press. That's a fantasy for young adults. And I have a variety of smaller things. I've got short fiction published all over the place and poetry as well.
I see. And if anyone was interested in finding out more about your work, do you have any online presence where they can go?
I do. I have a website, www.michellebarker.ca, and you can actually order my chapbook online as well through the website.
Well, that's very good. And what's the name of your upcoming book so that we can find it easily?
It's called The Beggar King.
Ah, The Beggar King. Sounds interesting.
I hope so.
All right. So, do you have any other further upcoming projects that you would like to talk about?
We have actually a book of poetry coming out. I shouldn't say we. It's Susan Musgrave and Mona Fertig are putting it together. It's called Forcefield, and it's an anthology of, I believe, 77 women poets in British Columbia. And that is going to be coming out in April, and there's going to be a launch in Vancouver in April for that book. And I think that's going to be pretty exciting. It's bringing all these poets together from all over BC. So, and other than that, no, not at this point. I'm working on a couple of different projects, but they're not at the point where I would want to say too much about them. So,
I see. And that happens all too often, I think, in creative fields.
Yeah, you know, you don't want to talk it out, that's for sure. And it almost feels like jinxing it if I start to tell you about it. So I think I'm just going to keep it secret for now. So
I see. And we've also had other guests and potential guests on our show that can't talk about the work because of non-disclosure agreements they sign with the people who actually own them.
Oh, no, that's not my problem. I worry more about the fact that if you talk it out, then you've almost sort of canceled out your reason for writing it. And so in general, I don't find that to be a very good idea. So.
Yes, and that is a very good piece of advice. Do you have any more advice that you might like to share with up-and-coming people who might potentially be considering a creative career?
Oh, yeah, I have a few things I could tell you. I read a wonderful book about writing by Annie Lamott called Bird by Bird. If anybody hasn't read it, it's fantastic. And she's very funny. She's a wonderful writer. And she has a chapter in that book called Shitty First Drafts. And it is probably the best piece of advice I've ever read for writing, because what it does is it takes the pressure off of you. You know, when you sit down with either the blank screen or the blank page and you say to yourself, okay, I'm going to write a story, you put a lot of pressure on yourself to write a good story because you figure that it's supposed to come out right the first time. And her idea is to take that pressure off by telling yourself that it really doesn't matter what kind of work it is that you write at when you first start, just get it down on paper. And, you know, you can work with it after that. And for me, that's just been huge. It's been a really, really important part of the process that you don't put so much pressure on yourself.
I see. And just to give people an idea of an example, how long did it take for you to end up published from when you started drafting things?
Oh, well, I'll give you the example of my novel, actually, which is, it's a terrifying example. I started that novel when my son was in grade 2. And by the time I sold it, he was in grade 12. I don't know if that's really the norm. It probably isn't. There was a pretty steep learning curve because I was writing fantasy, and I had never written fantasy before, so I really didn't know what I was doing. But there was also a long, long process of revising that novel over and over again, sometimes really starting over. I had an agent for a while, then that didn't work out. I had one publisher who wanted it, and then he changed his mind. You know, it was just a series of these sorts of things, and then I had probably about 50 rejections from publishers and agents before I finally found one that was interested. But in that process, the revision was the most important thing, because really every time I got a piece of advice and I listened to it, the book got better. And, it, you know, progressively it got better and better and better. So the whole, it was a wonderful process, but it was quite painful.
I see. And you mentioned having an agent and then losing it. Was it difficult to acquire an agent the first time?
In general, it actually is. For some reason, I got really lucky. And I have a feeling it's because somebody must have put a good word in for me. I don't think that it happened by itself. And she was terrific. I mean, it was a great relationship. It wasn't as if we had a falling out or anything. But I think the way agents work in general is that they have their list of publishers that they rely on. And they start at one and they go through to 15 or however many it is. And if they reach number 15 and they've all said no, then that's the end of the deal. And they say, well, I'm very sorry. It was nice working with you, but you know, I'm not going to be able to make any money off you, so we'll go our separate ways, which is essentially what happened. But even that process was good because, she worked with me in terms of what the book might look like. And we did have somebody who was quite interested who had me rewriting the book as well. But it just wasn't the right fit, that's all. And, you know, it's important to sort of not take these things personally and realize that often that's what it is. It's just not the right fit between you and a publisher or whatever. And you have to, you know, make the work better and find the right person. And so persistence was a pretty important part of it as well.
Yes, and I think that that's also good advice for people who are thinking of up and coming into the literary world is finding representation.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, I didn't have an agent in the end. Once she and I separated, I continued on my own. And so do you need an agent? I don't know. I mean, I managed without one. They certainly open doors for you. There's no doubt about that. There's a whole list of publishers that won't even look at you unless you have an agent. So it can be an important thing. They're hard to get. I don't know what the verdict is on that. I think probably if you ask 10 people, you'll get 10 different opinions. So,
and likely so. And hopefully on Skull's Hall, we'll have a chance to do exactly that.
That would be good. It would be interesting. Yeah.
Yes. Are you in a writer's guild at the moment?
A writer's group, yes. We have a group up in Penticton. I also get a lot out of what I'm doing with the master's program because I'm taking a fiction class, actually. Annabelle Lyon teaches it. She's fantastic. And we're a group of 12, I believe. And we have an exchange every week of writing that we're working on. And so that becomes like a writer's group as well in a lot of ways because, you know, you present your work and then people basically take it apart and tell you what's wrong with it. But it's fantastic. It's a great process. I've learned a huge amount from this program.
I see. All right. Well, do you have any final parting thoughts for our listeners out there? Anything that you would like them to know?
Oh, my. Anybody who wants to be a writer, I just think it's really important that you persist and try to find other writers. I think the community of writers is a really, really important part of this because it's a very solitary profession. And when you can get together with other writers who are working on, you know, similar projects and who face this, you know, similar situations and demands, it's really important to connect with other writers and become part of this community. I've always found that the writing community is a very supportive one. Even though writing seems like it would be a competitive business, and in one sense it is, I think if you're part of the writing community, you all sort of look out for each other, help each other with contacts. If you hear of a contest or something, you know, you pass it on, and we all seem to sort of hang together, and it's quite nice.
Mm-hmm. And longtime listeners of our program will recognize this bit of advice from other guests we've had on the show, networking being essential. Well, thank you very much, Michelle.
You're welcome.
And coming up in just a moment, we're going to be hearing some of Michelle's work. So stay tuned here on CITR 101.9 FM. So
awesome!
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 Awesome! Awesome!
That is awesome. Join Jason on a spiritual and musical journey to becoming relentlessly awesome every Thursday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. only on CITR. By the way, you're awesome.
Oh, welcome back to Skald's Hall here on CITR 101.9 FM, and we're here with our guest, Michelle Barker.
Hi, still
Hello
here.
Again, still there. And we're about to hear some of your work, so can you set that up for us? What is it we're about to hear?
Yeah, I published a chapbook of poetry called Old Growth Clear Cut, and these are poems from Haida Gwaii, a trip I took with my sister-in-law probably about 5 years ago now. We spent, I think, about 10 days up there, and it is just, if you've never been, it is the most beautiful, blessed place in the world. I just loved it. And it was an interesting place because I think a lot of people go up there almost as a form of healing. And my sister-in-law had just lost her husband to cancer. And I was sort of going through this process with my book where my agent had just dumped me and I was not sure what I was going to do. And so the two of us sort of got together and thought, we're just going to go up there and, you know, hike in the trees and see the old growth forest and everything. And it turned into this fantastic journey. And I ended up writing a whole bunch of poems from it. And so that's what I'm going to read to you from. The chapbook opens with a quote. Actually, it opens with two quotes, but I'm only going to read one of them. And it is Ian Lord from Spruce Roots magazine. So the quote is, "On Haida Gwaii, as elsewhere, old growth forests are perceived as decadent by a timber industry determined to liquidate these threatened ecosystems and replace them with managed tree farms, also contradictorily known as working forests." So the first poem I'm going to read is called Decadence of an Old Growth Forest. A cathedral, too, is decadent. Just look at the wasted square footage, the stone they might have used for shopping malls. And here, this stained glass. What is the purpose of a window you can't see through? Candles left burning at all hours, even when no one is there. And don't get me started on the vertical loss of space. 5 floors of apartments, at least. Artwork on the ceiling, as if anyone looks up anymore. Prayer is decadent, and silence. So too peace. And the other poem I'm going to read from this chapbook is called Skidans. And Skidans was a Haida village that basically just got worn down, worn away. And we took a boat. I can't even remember the island that we went around. I'm sorry, my memory is terrible. But in any case, we visited this little village of Skidans that had been sort of worn away by time. And I was quite interested in that, so I wrote a poem about that as well. And it's called Skidans. Time has worn the wood smooth, the totems of this ancient Haida village sun-bleached, tilted, or fallen. The carvings mostly faded, though on some you can still see the dulled bumps of bear claws, or where the fins once were on the supernatural whale. We are the tourists, the white man, the reason, besides smallpox, this village is no longer here. And we don't get it. Why not rebuild, repaint, plan tours, charge admission? Why allow time to have her way with history? Shrug and watch the longhouses surrender. We don't see the beauty in the cedar that has grown straight through an old totem. We don't see the possibility of transformation. Sorry, should I continue?
Yes.
Okay. The next one I want to read is from an online magazine called The Centrifugal Eye, and they actually also put out hard copy journal as well, and it's quite an interesting little magazine. It's a Canadian magazine, and they have usually themed submissions, and the one that I'm going to read from was about sense memories, and the sense of scent. That sort of comes out sounding funny, the sense of smell. And it was when she put out that theme, I had a poem that I'd been struggling with for a long time, because I'd always been very fascinated by the idea that dogs can smell fear. And I'd ask myself, what does fear smell like? What is that? Because I've seen dogs. They know when a person is afraid, and it is as if they can smell it. And so I struggled with that for a long time. I had this poem that I'd written that was very abstract about the smell of fear. It was like the smell of cobwebs, and I don't know. In any case, it wasn't working, and I knew that it wasn't working. And then during the MFA summer workshop, I took a workshop with Susan Musgrave, and one of the bits of advice that I came away with from that workshop was the importance of being specific instead of abstract. And so when I came back to look at this poem, because I really wanted to try to make it work, I asked myself the question, well, when was I really afraid? And then I knew. I mean, the poem just came down pretty much in one go. I knew exactly what to write about. So that's what I'm going to read. So in fact, it's actually based on a true story. And it's called Fear. A dog can smell it. Fear. As present as that man who followed you into Tim Hortons and sat at a table nearby watching you. His eyes burned the back of your neck, leaving when you left, and then mercifully gone as you slipped into London Drugs to buy clothes hangers. Until later, when you went back to your car, there he was, waiting, legs outstretched, his black cowboy boots with the pointed steel toes resting out the open window of his car, as if he had all the time in the world and was saving it for you. The dog can see that man's smile and how quickly you got into your car, how you drove with one eye fixed on the rearview mirror, never quite sure if he was following, how you wondered for days if he had found out where you lived, and if one day he would be waiting outside your house, and this time you wouldn't be so lucky. The memory of him smells like rust and sticks to you like damp cobwebs in a darkened basement, no bottom, no edges, just the flat space between heartbeats, when all you can do is run and pray no one is chasing you like a hound on a scent. The last piece I'm going to read for you started out, well, it started out as a problem I was trying to work out. I used to live in Quebec. I lived in Quebec for about 10 years, and every year, you know, we'd have a lot of snow, of course, in the winter, and then there'd be the thaw, and you'd be driving along the highway, and we would always see one boot sitting by the side of the road. And my kids and I would laugh about this. We'd say, who throws one boot out the window? I mean, how does one boot end up by the side of the road? And so I started thinking about this, and I came up with 14 explanations for the reason why there might be a boot by the side of the road. And it was quite quirky, and I didn't think I'd ever be able to sell it. I sent it out to Grain, and they picked it up right away, and she actually has said that it's probably one of her favorite pieces that she's ever published, which is kind of nice. In the end, I had to shorten it for last summer's workshop, because the man who runs the student reading programs gives us 3 minutes, and if we go over it, he basically humiliates us, so we have no choice but to stick to that 3 minutes, and so I had to cut the 14 explanations down to 7. So it's now called 7 Explanations, and it is going to be reprinted in the anthology Force Field that Susan Musgrave and Mona Fertig are putting out this spring. So it's called 7 Explanations. 7 Explanations for the lone boot that sits by the highway every summer. Every summer a different boot, but only one. A sole survivor flung out the window of a passing car as 1. A cry for individualism. A song of the peculiar, because why wear two boots when you can wear one? Two boots votes conservative, drives a minivan, and watches reruns of Friends. But one boot, one boot refuses to carry a cell phone. One boot knows how to cook a decent vegetarian chili. One boot might even read your palm. Though why stop there? Why not two? Believe in the boot. Embrace it as the abandoned relic of a new religion called Zen Buddhism. Because the boot is alone, and it is empty. It is on the way to somewhere, but also in the moment of being on the road again. Though for those who won't go that far, let us declare the boot 3. A temporary statue erected to the wandering soul. A nod to all one-legged men. Or the natural result of drunkenness. Except we are overlooking the odds that 4. Elvis is involved. Since we know the blue suede shoe was a sign that he would be back, and he might use footwear. But then what are we to make of 5? The unlikely disappearance of old Mrs. Biddle, who dips into the cooking sherry when she bakes, or at least that's what it says in the police report. And witnesses claim one afternoon in the middle of baking she went out to the road to fetch the mail, and next thing you know, all that's left of her is one boot, and the police can't make sense of it because they are unaware of standard alien policy, which is to leave one boot behind as a sort of extraterrestrial riddle which no one ever gets. But if you happen to be 6, the philosophical sort, you'll ask, if a boot falls out the window of a car and no one sees it beside the road, is it really there? And you would have an answer, but not to the question of the lone boot, because for that you need 7, a poet, who would tell you that one boot by the roadside is a metaphor for lack, a statement of loneliness, a choice not made. The fellow could have thrown out both boots, but didn't. That the lone boot, in its beautiful mystery, is ultimately incomplete, as every rational explanation is incomplete, as this, too, is an incomplete. And you can't actually see it, of course, on the page, but in fact, the whole thing is one sentence that never ends. There's no period at the end, so it's all sort of hanging there.
I see. Well, this was Michelle Barker here on Scald's Hall at CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you. It was an absolute pleasure.
Yes. Into CITR 101.9 FM. So, welcome back to
your schedule. Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
You are tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM, and we're here with our guest, Daniela Elza. Hello.
Hello, Brian.
And Daniela is a local poet and alumni of SFU. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Who is Daniela Elza?
I am, well, as you said, a poet. I also just finished my doctorate in philosophy of education from SFU. So in some ways, I'm an educationalist as well. I've lived on three continents. I moved to Canada in 1999. And in some ways, Vancouver feels home, and as much home as it's going to get for me, because I've traveled and lived in so many different places that home is a very, very difficult concept for me. And in some ways, Vancouver feels so much like home because so many people are from somewhere else, and being from somewhere else is not your most identifiable characteristic.
Tell us a little bit about your journey as an artist. Why did you decide to become a poet?
Wow. Well, as far back as I remember and can remember, I have delighted in words and played and learned everything that I loved by heart. And I also, perhaps as a child, had a lot of solitude and time for ideas to grow. I also loved big ideas. And as time progressed, I went through my master's and my doctorate. Poetry was something that just kept happening as something that I did. And it was always there for me, regardless of where I was, what country, what degree, and what culture or language I was going through. And some time ago, maybe about 10 years ago, I realized that poetry is not going away. And I also realized I'd come to a crisis moment in my degree, at the time where I had to work with metaphor, write about metaphor and the poetic consciousness, but I was not kind of allowed to do it in the form of poetry. And that's when things kind of came together and I brought the poetry, the poetic and the philosophic together in my work.
But what was it like to experience both being an academic, writing about poetry as an academic, and being a poet?
It's difficult. And the reason I found it difficult is that I wanted to bring the poetry into my academic life, but I also at the same time gave myself the criteria that what I wrote in that space will have to also qualify in the literary world, if we can divide them. I didn't want to divide them. I wanted to walk this path at the same time. And in some ways, I was watching for the signs. Like, for instance, the first year that I got some work published in literary journals, I also got some work accepted in an academic journal. And in fact, even the person who was running that journal started a section, new section in the journal called Philosophical Fragments, in which they published my work for the first time. So to me, those were little signs that I can do this. And I kept watching myself that I had to keep walking that path. Even though it felt like I was dividing myself, really, I was integrating.
So you became a poet after having a bit of experience living in different places, experiencing different things. Do you think that helped to form your poetic voice?
I think so. Even though I haven't written very many poems about my life in Nigeria, though I do go back now and keep finding little places in which I can enter, because that was a childhood time. And it's interesting how certain places call to you at different times. But I think that traveling is an amazing way to shake yourself off of a kind of one way of seeing the world. And in some ways, if you have that trouble, just travel. And also, traveling is an interesting way of putting yourself in that child mind again, because when you don't know what to pay attention to, what's meaningful in terms of the language, the culture, the gestures, you are placed in that place of the child observing the world for the first time and learning about it. And I think that's a beautiful place for a poet to be.
Do you do any work in languages beyond English?
I have done some when I was back in Bulgaria doing my philology degree in English. I was interpreting, translating. I taught English. That kind of work. I know very, very little bit of Russian, enough to get in trouble with probably. And I studied French, but I really never took to speaking it.
Have there been any difficulties or moments of crisis in your career as an artist?
Well, I guess the moment I described where I brought the poetry into my academic life, that was a moment of crisis. In fact, I had left SFU at that point. because I realized that that was not, I didn't want to do the same old thing where you just read the stuff and then you kind of regurgitate it on the page. And that was like, no, I'm too old for that. I think I need to do something different. And I knew I was there to do something different, but I wasn't sure what it was yet. So I left, and then eventually I found my way back with the people who could support what I was doing. So that was a big crisis moment. But that was also a moment where I decided, nope, I'm not dividing myself anymore. I have to bring myself back together. And I would never regret that decision.
And so that sounds like it ended in a moment of triumph.
Yes, it was good.
Yes.
That was good.
Have there been any other moments of triumph that you can remember?
Well, I guess, you know, the first time you get published, that's always something that any writer would remember. I do remember having, back in Sofia University, there was a little journal that they were doing, and at that time I remember publishing two poems. So maybe those were my first publications. And then when I went to England on a exchange program with a school, I was interviewed, and I had written a poem about St. Ives, which is like the southwestern toe of the British Isles. And they published that in a newspaper. So those were like, you know, thrilling moments. And then, of course, the first time I got published in Canada, which was probably way back in, well, what would that be, 2005 maybe? That's not that far, not that long ago. But those are always.
Do you have any recent or upcoming projects that you would like to tell people about?
Well, after The Weight of Dew got published last year by Mother Tongue Publishing, I had another manuscript that was making its rounds, and I thought that was going to be my first book. And that was what is going to be now called Milk Tooth Bane Bone, and it's coming out with Leaf Press. And that book is very dear to me because it explores perhaps more of my own story, but it's not really about me. And it's not even about the crows that persistently seem to appear in the book all the time, but it's more of an exploration of and an inquiry into language, into poetry, and into self, and perhaps even into being, if I could be as brave to say that.
Will these soon be available for purchase?
Yes, April is the launch month. It will be out in April. I have some readings lined up already. I will have everything up on my website. So mid-April probably the launch of the book would happen. We don't have a date, precise date yet. Today I got the manuscript and I was working on the final edits.
You mentioned you have a website. Can you tell us what it is?
Yes, my website. It's called Strange Places. Now, if you Google it, don't Google Strange Places by itself. Just Google Daniela Elza Strange Places. I think it started in about 2007. I had no idea what it was supposed to be, but I was in a conversation with a friend, and somehow I knew I wanted to start writing and have a presence on the web, and I wasn't sure in what way, because I wasn't, you know, I hadn't thought of what a poet's website should be like. And I knew that it was supposed to be called Strange Places, all of a sudden out of a conversation. And I started it, and it just became like this void where I would write something up and post it. It was a very interesting experience to write, post, and feel like it goes out into the void, and you don't know who's reading it and what they're doing with it. And yeah, so that's where it started. But now, and I would write little pieces, but now it's mostly events and news and links to my work and what I do.
And we here on Scald's Hole will provide links to Strange Places on our social media feeds. We are on Facebook and Twitter, and so we'll provide some links. One final question. Do you have any advice for people that are just starting out as artists, for new poets?
If you love poetry to the point where you do it all the time, and that's the default, because that's what I found myself doing. That was the default thing I would do when I'm not doing anything else. Stick with it. And if it's its own reward for you, do it. Everything else, the publication, the books, comes almost as a pleasant or unpleasant side effect. But unless you love it, unless you can spend infinite time in it, then don't do it. Otherwise, it will become work and a chore. The thing that gets me through is the love for it and the fact that I would just do it anyways as my own, I don't know what to call it, as my own occupation or preoccupation. When I'm not working or looking after my kids, but the poet is always a poet. You're always working.
And thank you very much. And coming up in just a moment, we are going to be hearing some of Daniela's poetry. So stay tuned.
Conservation is the first and best resource option for BC. Do your part. Turn off the lights when you leave a room and unplug your cell phone charger when charging is complete. Visit bchydro.com to find out more ways you can make a difference. This message brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
And welcome back to us here on CITR 101.9 FM in Scalds Hall with our guest Daniela. Hello again.
Hello, Brian.
And we're going to be hearing some of her work now. So what are we going to hear first?
Well, you picked alternate grammars. There's a quote, an epigraph by Sue Sinclair. Pretend we haven't been here before. Pretend we don't know. Alternate grammars. Walk off the asphalt into the grammar of this acreage, into the tenses of wild grasses as high as your thigh, and into the scattered light of trees. No step here is defined. In the tension between shadow and sunlit spots, the wind shifts the borders of my nouns, teeming with the small life of prepositions. In the definite article of this place, knowledge is always being revised. And the trees are not lost in the punctuation, their leaves such yellow they could be their own source of light. Step into the present tense of ghost logs and grow dumb while your ears search for new words. In the conditionals of storms, lightning, and drought, a fact is a dead bird, a crack in the earth, a perfectly charred tree. Boulders marked by the past tense of ancient moss, its delicate new tendrils embrace white skulls and bones. Wade through the underbrush, pushing up and closing in on once hacked out paths. What breaks the light here is not what stands in its way. What breaks the light is that I walk here thinking. I know this place, like my own name, in the perfect tense of having learned. Yet, every step questions where I stop, where the sky begins. The asphalt still only runs two ways. From there, the trees are points of reference, a stylized calligraphy. I have come to learn how the wind can whisper no words, and the boughs listen with trepidation. How the rain can tap out a message on my bare skin. I have come to learn how the grass rises after I have sat here, straightening each letter, each curve of my name, until I am only 11 stalks of grass. So yeah, this I guess this poem has a lot of themes that show up in my work. I was realizing about, I'm very interested in how we know, what knowing is. And in some ways, I guess I'm tempted to read now the poem that carries the name of the book, The Weight of Dew, which is also about what we know. And knowledge is so mediated in our world, and I'm very curious about that knowing that is not so mediated. What is it to know before it becomes mediated? The weight of dew. Can I fill these words with what is not intended? With what the river keeps hidden under her tongue? With the maps birds carve in my marrow? Fill my bones with air, my eye with their dying? To wait on the riverbank long enough to know what knowing looks like before it is disturbed, stepped on, sanitized, poked with a stick, put in a vial, to know the shape of me, nameless, my given names left out like shoes I was meant to fill. They gather dew now, It slides down their tongues. I watch them through this open door where even the clock wipes its face clean. So yeah, this is from The Weight of Dew. That was published last year by Mother Tongue Publishing. The year before that, I kind of self-published a little book called The Book of It. And that was kind of more like a gift to myself after graduating. I wanted to rewrite my thesis in a playful way to perhaps capture a little something of what it was trying to say or do. In some ways, I kind of thought, when I was writing it, I was wondering, what am I really trying to say? What am I doing? What am I saying? And then the conclusion I came up with, it's that we don't all have to write poems, but we all have to live poetically. And I find that that is a really important thing in our world today. And by what I mean by poetically, I mean having that attention and that ecological, I guess, mind, or that will allow us to perceive our world and its ecologies and wholeness. I think we've become so fragmented in the way we do things. Anyways, I'll just read a little bit from the book. Robert Bringhurst says, "We're all of us here in the hidden house of the unnamed." And it's the book starts, it's wrapped in a little bit of a story. It starts on the playground with a child. "Once the bell rings and breaks a string of words that have tentatively been arranging themselves over the whole of recess, every recess, that I have almost developed a taste for it, it stays out as I walk back to class. When teacher asks me a question and I cannot answer it, does it matter which letter I pick? She asks, what does it take? But limits my options to A, B, C, D, E. I pick none of the above because it does not fit. Then teacher tells me of its measurements. 1,000 words can be more, not less, and it should be summed up in a few words. I embark on this journey, confused, uncertain. Even my family and friends start asking, what is it? So, I attempt to define it. It comes willing and open, leaves closed with brass hinges and a lock. Teacher says, now you have the key. It is the cherry blossoms falling against the tick-tock of the hands, the petals thought against the cheek. It worships with the certainty of a needle pulling the thread through. At university, they said, they will not take my word for it. They took cash and 2 pieces of ID instead. It cannot follow the recipe because it knows what it should not leave out. It sleeps in a field guide to the possible, leaves fresh footprints in the margins, wild flowers in the footnotes. It changes the labels on the furniture, often imagines the room without it. It is every poem, but every poem is not it. It often sleeps in the pockets of children, and when they pull it out to show you how its fur shines, you are ashamed for not believing. So that's a little taste of the book of it.
That started off as a thesis you wrote?
Well, that is just me trying to find a different way of rewriting my thesis.
I see. Your thesis was originally an academic document?
Yes, which I managed to write most of in the form of poetry, which was lovely. But it takes work, and it takes like minds that are, you know, like-minded. In fact, what happens is when I was doing my thing, I didn't know there was this other thing going on at the time called poetic inquiry. So once I ran into the poetic inquiry crowd, I was like, oh, this is my crowd. And poetic inquiry is basically using poetry as a way of inquiring into the world. And then I right away had a place. I knew that I could call myself, I could call what I was doing something. Yeah, I had a word for it. Well, you see, the thing is that the tools you use are numerous. It could be dance, it could be painting. It depends what you pick, your own tools, what you're drawn to. But ultimately, I think we're all going for the same places, for the same things. And it's just the expression changes and differs. But the depth we're trying to get to, I think, is similar and the same.
Yes.
Yes, and my interest in working between poetry and philosophy is, again, inspired by going back. It's not a new thing. It's in the East. They've done that for thousands of years. And I think, again, goes down to that fragmentation. I don't think fragmenting our world serves us. And we have rendered both philosophy and poetry and marginalized them, rendered them kind of almost irrelevant to our lives. And I think that's wrong. I think that's a mistake. And we have also marginalized them. So in some ways, when I think of what I do, I'm like, I'm working with two marginalized fields. That's sad in some ways. But at the same time, I can't help myself. So I have to trust that, at least that.
Well, thank you. What else do you have for us today?
I could read a few things from my upcoming book. That was is called Milktooth Bane Bone. It will be coming out in April with Leaf Press. And I was very fortunate to have to work with Aslyn Hunter on the editing. And she has written an introduction to the book, which I'm thrilled about. It's amazing when you find the people who understand what you're doing and reflect and speak it back to you. I think that's an amazing experience, which I feel glad to have had with Aslyn Hunter. Okay, so I don't know if I could tell you what the book is about, because if I could tell you what it's about and sum it up in a few sentences, perhaps I shouldn't have written it. Mm-hmm. It's a journey. It's an exploration into story, language, being, mythology, perhaps. So I'll just read some bits. The crows are one of the leitmotifs of the book, and they keep coming. The way this book came about, actually, it's still a mystery to me. It's for over the course, perhaps, of 10 years, I've been writing with the image of the crow, and these poems have their own flavor, and one time I decided I'm just going to have to sit down and put all this together and figure out what it's about, because it was so persistent, insistent, and every time I hear the crows, I cannot not pay attention. And that's kind of maybe where it came. Today, the crow in the pine is a story. Its harsh, charred voice pulls the morning out of the water, ripples the city's dissolving dreams. They walk in broad daylight through memory lanes lined with walls so thin you can see where the dumpsters used to be benches on which we sat and held hands. Under the water, a book turning pages. Slow, words come undone, float to the surface, black, oily, and slick. Flow under bridges, arches, aches. The marrow of the quiet, the writing down, and what a crow tears out of such silence. I write between drop, eavesdropping. Two crows in a tree like ears, listen. Again, I fool myself. I can even get close to writing rain. These ghosts on the page that pull at me, drag me out of my skin into certainties. If we have to be truly philosophical, we will not say a word. In the linden tree, below the balcony, the breaking of twigs, the weaving of nest, crows here speak so effortlessly of rain. Tapping on leaves, and the strip of light above the horizon again delivers us to the eye of the moon, to the night where we are dark thought perched in the trees of dreams. With first light, you notice speckled turquoise eggs. Rain isn't divisible from this. They perch behind my ear. Nest there in my hair, their carrion breath permeates the spaces between temples full of restless wings. The place turns so black, I could mistake it for grief. On other days they settle with such ease, ink in white birches. Among first cherry blossoms they exchange places, swaying in the paper-thin wind as if unaware of the contrasts they create. I may not even be an impulse in the shiny muscle eye as they lift up the crowns of trees, in each claw a piece of sky. We weave our destinies daily, with a scream and a rattle, a whine and a coo, a caw and a cackle. Among the city's neon signs, humming, homing us in, crooning from warm beds, from cedar-lined nests, cradling speckled eggs. When we chopped the trees down and offered you dumpsters to dive in, back alleys to raise your young, what do you choose to line your nests with? So this gives you a little taste of some poems. It's not separate poems. It's basically maybe like a long poem. I don't know.
It will be available in April?
Yes.
And we can find it through your website?
Yes, through my website, Leaf Press's website, come to launches. I'll be reading. I do quite a bit of reading in Vancouver, so.
Do you have any upcoming engagements?
Yes, on April 15th, I will be reading on the North Shore with the North Shore Writers. It's kind of a reading and questions and answers, so it's a presentation, I guess. They will be a bit of a interesting experiment on the 24th of April, and I believe that might be in the little adjacent house to next to Presentation House, again in North Van. I'm working with some musicians, and one of them is really inspired by some of these crow poems, and we have worked together previously as they will accompany me improvising alongside me. But this time he wanted to do something different. He wanted to bring more instruments together, like maybe, I don't know, a bunch of instruments. And so he's writing a bit of a, you know, notations. And it's not so much that it's not going to be improvising. It'll be kind of improvising, but he's going to bring us together in certain moments because it might be hard to bring a bunch of instruments together quickly. So whatever he's doing, I'm excited to find out. So that'll be on the 24th of April and probably in the little studio. I don't know what it's called, but it's like a little tiny house next to Presentation House. I believe that's where it's going to be. On May 23rd, I will be reading with Aslan Hunter at Twisted Poets, and that's at the Cottage Bistro at 7. The launch of the book perhaps will be mid-April sometime. I'll also be reading on March 18th. I'm helping a couple of writers from Prince George launch their books here, and I will be joining them at Co-op Bookstore on March 18th. So it just goes on and on.
And we encourage our listeners to go out and attend these events if they at all can. Well, we've been here at Skulls Hall with Daniela. Thank you very much for coming down.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
And welcome back to us here at CITR 101.9 FM. And those were our guests for today. Daniela and Michelle, thank you very much, both of you, for being on the show. And thank you for listening to us here at Skulls Hall at CITR 101.9 FM. And a couple of other quick shout-outs for things that are going on in the area. The Vagabond Players production of Faulty Towers, which I am a part of, is still going on. We're running this week and our finale will be next Saturday, next week. I want to thank everybody for coming out, for we have sold out all of our performances. And I don't mean we've sold out all of our remaining performances. I mean we have sold out all of the performances that we did. And as we cannot be held over because the set is going to be needed for another play, we will be finishing our run as scheduled next week. I just want to thank everybody out there who heard about the program through us or through any other media outlet for coming out and enjoying the program, and it has been a lot of fun to do. Speaking of the Vagabond Players production, their next play is going to be for the pleasure of seeing her again. And we are very lucky because here on Skulls Hall, we are very likely going to be having the cast of For the Pleasure of Seeing Her Again on as guests. So that'll be kind of nice. Actually, that's going to be very nice. And so it is coming up on to 2 o'clock. It is a few minutes before the hour. And coming up next, we will be having Radio Zero with Tyler and Cam. So don't go anywhere. Kick back, relax, enjoy your Friday, and enjoy the fact that it is a Friday without precipitation, which is quite unusual. Thank you very much for listening to us here at Skulls Hall on CITR 101.9 FM.